Hello and welcome to this episode of the Global Challengers podcast brought to you by the School for Cross-Faculty Studies at Warwick. My name is Linus Pardo and today we are going to be confronting the topic of the apocalypse, the end of the world, a small and insignificant topic that concerns us on a daily basis. I'll be joined today by two of our teaching fellows. And if you want to learn a little bit more about what we do here at the School for Cross-Faculty Studies, you can go to warwick.ac.uk/GSD or warwick.ac.uk/liberalarts. And don't forget, you can also listen back to previous episodes that we've done here on the Global Challengers podcast. So let's talk about the apocalypse. Take a cursory glance at TV or cinema listings from the past few years, and the apocalypse is everywhere, perpetually portrayed in a huge array of manifestations from AI through to zombies and everything in between that you can imagine. And that's really been proliferated from online subscription TV platforms, and that's helped the genre along. We have The Walking Dead, The Handmaiden's Tale, Black Mirror, The 3%, all depict the collapse of human life in their own particular way. In films, music, art, literature, we're constantly reminding ourselves of the fragility of human civilization, letting ourselves into the fantasy, or horrors, of what the demise of that civilization might actually look like. But there are some subtleties here as well. The language of the apocalypse and of crisis of the human species has permeated through to our public discourse. Take some of these recent newspaper headlines. Here's one from the BBC, how antibiotic resistance could take us back to the Dark Ages. Or from The Guardian, Caroline Lucas on Heathrow and climate change, the apocalypse is happening. We might also remember some of the language that was used during the dramatic headlines of the migration crisis of the Mediterranean during 2014 and 15, where swarms and invasions were told to be reaching the shores of Europe every single day. So why do we continuously produce apocalyptic visions? Does it help us to understand the reality of the world around us? And given the challenging times that we currently live in, how might we prepare for a total or partial global breakdown of civilization? To discuss those little topics, I am joined today by, first of all, Dr. Gavin Schwartz-Lieper, Director of Undergraduate Studies and Student Experience for Liberal Arts at Warwick. His research interests include early modern literature and culture and developing creative pedagogies, especially in the liberal arts. And Gavin teaches a liberal arts optional module entitled The Apocalyptic Imaginary. Gavin, welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Linus.
And we're also joined by Dr. Leon Seeley-Huggins, Senior Teaching Fellow with GSD. His research interests include the sociology of climate change in the Caribbean and the impacts of neoliberalism on contemporary societies. Leon teaches a GSD optional module entitled Surviving the Apocalypse.
Yes, indeed. Running for the first time this year.
There we go. So let me ask you both to start with. You both teach on this subject of the downfall of civilization in one capacity or another. What brought you to that idea in the first place? And more generally, why are we so obsessed with apocalyptic narratives?
That's a really good question. For me, I think it was that, you know, the apocalypse is just fascinating. You know, there's something really, you know, on a personal level, I've always been attracted to zombie movies and video games and, you know, science fiction and all of this kind of stuff, these sort of imaginative narratives about really terrible situations. And I think it's, you know, it's in part that because we all grow up with variants on these stories, right? These are like fairy tales. They allow us to experience truly horrible scenarios in a safe kind of way. It lets us test out what we'd feel like, what emotions we'd have, what role, you know, we might play in these sort of really grand narratives. It gives us a chance to work through that in a kind of safe sort of way. And I think that that's something that, well, I think a lot of us are interested in, really.
Mm. Yeah, I'd echo that. I think one of my favorite films growing up was The Night of the Living Dead, the 1990s remake. Had a friend at school who was kind of obsessed with the film and made these audio tapes of recordings that were really eerie, taking sound kind of bites from the film. I guess in terms of my interest in relation to the teaching that I want to do, I guess that stems from an involvement in environmental politics and an awareness of some of the unfolding impacts of climate change and other forms of environmental or ecological catastrophe, and a real kind of overriding sense of an overriding sense that the action that needs to be taken in order to shift us onto a different trajectory that would be more in keeping with survival and the survival of the kinds of societies that we would, well, the kinds of the versions of societies that we enjoy here in the global north would require a different set of social organization and or social organizations, and that's not happening. So it's kind of like an attempt to try and track the unfolding present to see where we're headed, and it seems like there are a lot of apocalyptic kind of indicators, as you kind of outlined in your introduction.
Sure. So you can use the apocalypse as a stimuli for having an academic conversation about how we might solve some of those challenges. Maybe we'll come on and talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the show. Mm. Let me ask you, though, and Gavin, maybe this is a question for you. This isn't a new fascination. You know, I outlined some of the TV shows and films that we've been interested in the past few years, but actually we can trace this idea of a fascination with the end of the world way, way further back. So can we give any examples of that?
For sure. I mean, I think in some ways the oldest stories we have, or at least some of the oldest stories that we have, are about the end, you know, because I think people can come to grips with that in a very emotional sort of way, or at least they can try to. Maybe they fail. I don't know. And certainly even within my area of specialization in the early modern period, one of the things I became interested in was the Renaissance martyrologist John Fox, who was a Protestant, well, late in the reign of Henry VIII, and then he lived all the way through the Tudor period. And one of his sort of problems was how to convince people that the new, what was then the new Protestant church in England, was actually a historically legitimated church that went all the way back to Christ, right? That somehow the Catholic Church had become corrupted and not the true church. His was the true church, right? And one of the ways he did that was by thinking about the shape of history. You know, how do you categorize history? How do you know when all of the things that all the signs and signals and demarcations of time that are discussed in the prophetic bits of the Bible, how do you know that they're coming true? So for him, this was both a scholarly endeavor as well as a kind of a religious one, but it had very practical consequences, you know, looking around in the real world, the political world, the social world, for the kind of cues that the world is not just about to fall apart in a negative way, but in such a way as to prompt the second coming of the Messiah. So for him, there was a really kind of tangible reason to be doing this. And I think, you know, I became interested in this idea about the shape of history. You know, why do we, what narrative arc do we see unfolding when we look at contemporary events? How do we know if we're living in a revolutionary moment, a moment of crisis and change? You know, every generation has always thought everything was about to end. And so, you know, as a historian, as a literary scholar, it's kind of interesting to look back and see, you know, people pointing and saying, okay, no, I know all the old people said the world was going to end 20 years ago and it didn't, but now it really is going to end with the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, with environmental collapse, with, you know, the zombie apocalypse, whatever it is that you pick out, there's always seems to be a sense of imminent danger that helps to focus the mind.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, you can go through from biblical times to the early modern period to even scholars like Marx. You know, mm-hmm. their whole meta narrative was built upon this idea that everything was eventually going to hit either the end or a utopia of some description. We clearly seem to have those ideas with us still today. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that we use that imagination, those visions? You know, we think artistically of paintings from the early modern period all the way through today to, you know, the famous images of nuclear weapons and things. Why do we use those images in films and the like to get at the apocalypse? Why not just use language?
I think it's partially because, you know, we think in a lot of complex ways about the feelings that we have about the relationship, the tensions that exist between us as individuals, within us as individuals, and the way in which we relate to the wider community, the wider society. You know, and we talk a lot about the ways in which people try to figure themselves as either belonging or not belonging to particular communities, the way in which they perceive a community, or like Leon was saying, a way of life as being under threat. Often this is categorized in terms that are meant to be frightening and sort of all-encompassing, very bombastic, and yet they tend to be tied to really specific things. So even if we look in the Book of Revelation, you know, which is classical, obviously foundational narrative in so much of the world, you know, quite a lot of the signs of the apocalypse are not just that the sky is raining blood or something, but it's really specific weird moments that in and of themselves don't seem to mean very much. But these are ideas, these are features that people keep going back and obsessing over. Has this moment come now? Is this the thing that the text was talking about? That kind of constant comparison, I think, requires not just that we read the literal words, you know, I mean, those change, the meanings change all the time. But we try to think in a broader, more holistic kind of way about how we represent these forces. And that's really, I think, one of the reasons you see so many different kinds of narratives about the end of the world, even when they're speaking to the same base tension.
So do you think it's a case then of we use those narratives to help us make sense of everything around us, and often we reflect that backwards?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, even the word apocalypse comes from the classical Greek for revelation, you know, that which is revealed. So I think in some ways, it, you know, in a religious sense, that's about the revelation of the Messiah in the Christian tradition and the Jewish as well. But it's also, you know, in a more sort of broad kind of sense, it's about what we reveal about ourselves.
I think that's a really interesting point about, you know, what is the actual etymology of the word of apocalypse. You know, we all often think of it as being about, you know, an infestation of zombies or artificial intelligence or whatever it may be. But actually, it means, you know, amongst many things, a new way of thinking. So can we use apocalyptic ideas to restructure the society around us, or does it create a sense of, well, everything's, you know, everything's gone wrong, and you know, we might as well all just, you know, run off into the woods and hide, as it were? Or can we use it as a way of motivating change?
I think that's an important question, and in short, I guess I don't have an answer to it either way. But I was reading something interesting the other day, which was reflecting on some of the latest sort of environmental reports that have come out, including the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change evaluation of the difference between a 1.5 degree centigrade rise and a 2.0 degree rise, and various other things. There's been a biodiversity report that came out, I think, last week, suggesting that that biodiversity loss is proceeding at a pace that hadn't been anticipated, and we'll see the mass extinction of a significant range of the life that exists on Earth. And what this piece was suggesting was, well, or what it was debating, considering, was whether or not in the face of that, people who are somewhat conscious of some of these things, or at least believe themselves to be conscious, because there's always the possibility that the science will be revised and kind of revised up or revised down, depending on what happens. But people who have an awareness of this kind of knowledge, do they have an entitlement to be alarmist and kind of, yeah, very like you were saying earlier, kind of bombastic in their accounts of what's coming and the scale of the threat? Or is there a duty to be optimistic and hopeful? Some environmental activists often emphasize the latter, saying that if you want to motivate people into action, you have to be optimistic. You can't use this kind of fear of impending catastrophe as a way forward. This article was arguing against that, kind of suggesting that almost like there's a responsibility to be realistic about the scale of the threat is, because unless you're realistic about the scale of the threat and therefore the scale of changes that are required, you won't be able to restructure society or reorganize society in such ways as to implement kind of or to avert the catastrophe. So I think that's one of the things that we've seen with the response to environmental harm that's happened so far, is that the solutions that have been proposed and that have been taken up tend to be very small, very incremental, which on the one hand is necessary and achievable, but on the other hand often doesn't get anywhere near sort of scratching the surface of implementing the kind of changes that need to happen.
Because it was one of the early criticisms that people had of the environmental movement, people like Al Gore, who's, you know, came out and delivered this spiel of apocalyptic facts. People saying, well, we can't relate to this, you know. And you think about the imagery of climate change as well, you know, you see a polar bear on an ice cap, you think, well that's, I can't relate to that. Whereas if you show you know, apocalyptic images of human society, how it could actually happen, you know, that might actually motivate people into action. Do you think that's a, you know, a valid criticism that people made in the first place?
Yeah, I think that there is an issue about, there's a general issue about where allocation in responding to the apocalypse. So one of the things that I want to look at in the course, Surviving the Apocalypse, next term, will be to address this kind of tendency towards a sort of Western European understanding of what apocalypse means, and particularly to think about all those instances throughout human history where people have experienced what must have felt like apocalyptic conditions. So I'm thinking, for example, of the genocide of indigenous Americans in North America with kind of settler colonialism, or I'm thinking of the transatlantic slave trade, or more recently the Holocaust. So for various people who went through these experiences, I mean, that must have felt like an apocalypse on one level, and it must have been an apocalypse. So I think it's not just about making these imaginaries and these stories and accounts more relatable to people by kind of humanizing them and kind of showing the connections between people's current existence and the future, but also showing that kind of making the connection to the pasts as well, that have similar conditions that have happened in the past and people's attempts to sort of respond to and deal with those, the fallouts of catastrophes and apocalyptic experiences.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point actually about the transatlantic slave trade, because it strikes me as a sort of a cruel irony of history that, you know, this is one of the examples of when people say, what will the apocalypse be like? We can say, we already know it happened. It has happened repeatedly throughout history. And that's a fantastic example where you had an external group of people come to a very large and, I mean, enormously complicated set of populations in a vast area, conglomerate them, pull them together, rip them apart from their homes, from their cultures, deny them their language, deny them their families, you know, everything that makes a society. That was taken away. They were reformed. That post-apocalyptic society was then reformed, for example, in the Caribbean. And we start to see a new post-apocalyptic culture starting to rise up in places like Haiti. We see the development of voodoo practices and traditions, which then themselves were co-opted by the global North and by North America and Hollywood in particular. And so in some ways, I find it funny, but not necessarily ha-ha funny, that when you're watching a zombie movie, you know, and we know that so much of kind of zombie culture is meant to be critiquing consumerism and capitalism. So many zombie movies are set in malls and cities and things like that. Well, really, that zombie tradition is cannibalizing the older zombie tradition that was itself a post-apocalyptic invention. So when we talk about the end of the world, I mean, obviously, we don't know always what it would actually be like. Of course not, but we can look backwards, just like Leon was saying, and say it has happened. Actually, groups of people have survived that. The question is, how bad will it be, and for whom?
That's a really interesting point. You know, to go through and think about various moments where, you know, you think about, say, some of the romantic literature that comes out in the early 19th century. You know, people who felt that the rise of industrialization was, you know, the ripping apart of society at its very core and its very roots, and you know, and trying to reconcile with that. You know, over and over again throughout human history, we have experienced moments of, you know, what must have felt like the end of the world, if not the end of an era, at least. So let's think about. I'm going to put you on the spot and force you to try and work out what you would do. What, you know, as educators in terms of educating the next generation for dealing with these crises. How do we think about major global challenges and designing responses to them?
Yeah, I guess that it's that question that my module was. I'm not going to claim that it's going to get anywhere near answering that question, but that was the question, I guess, the line of thinking that prompted the design of my module. And one of the hunches or kind of experiences that I have is that a lot of the kind of mainstream ways of educating, the kind of dominant models of pedagogy, don't really do a very good job of equipping students to think through the implications of this kind of scale of change. I mean, I think there's lots about kind of pre-existing curricula and education that can do that, and that there are many good educators who do that. But I also think that with this sort of latest kind of round of apocalyptic thinking and imaginaries, it's possible to think, well, to use it as a point at which to assess how might you equip students to think critically, to think collectively and less individualistically about how they might respond to the apocalypse. Because I think the sort of a lot of the dominant media and sort of commercial responses to the apocalypse. If you think about the tech bros from Silicon Valley who are buying up their bits of New Zealand, to the extent that the New Zealand government has now banned the sale of its territory to foreigners, partly to as a direct response to all of these kind of wealthy entrepreneurs coming and trying to secure their future in the face of the apocalypse. There's an incredibly individualistic response. And I think that's, for me, that it's about finding some kind of collective response and really, I guess, trusting the students and supporting them in thinking through what on earth a collective response to this set of challenges and threats might mean, but also what kind of educational process we have to go through to be able to arrive at a set of responses, or I don't want to say solutions, but yeah, a set of responses to the conditions.
Yeah, I think that, you know, your point about individualistic responses that are very cynical, I think is very true and also profoundly sad, because in many ways, you know, of course, these are major complex problems that can't, of course, they can't be solved by any one person, but they definitely can be contributed to by individuals. And one of the themes that runs throughout so many of these apocalyptic stories, and not just in the West, is about a sense of inevitability. You know, people get trapped into these trajectories where they feel like they can't escape. And, you know, elements of that may or may not be true. I'm not sure, you know, I can solve sort of sea level rise myself. But there are things that we definitely can't do. I mean, we're recording this the day before the American midterm election. And one of the things that I think one of the collective actions that we can take is to participate in government, is to say, you know, we do have levers and mechanisms by which we can influence the kind of policies that do take effect at the macro level. But I mean, even at the micro level, one of the case studies we look at in the apocalyptic imaginary is about the Bundys, who were the ranchers out in the American West, who took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in 2014. And that was badged as a very kind of right-wing, you know, fringe movement in the U.S. that was very kind of secular. But in fact, that is, you know, they are members of a far-right, excommunicated, disavowed Mormon sect that reads the American Constitution as an apocalyptic document. So these are individuals who are trying to bring about the end of the world because they want the Messiah to come, right? They have a very specific religious goal in terms of what their actions are. And yet they are running for governor. You know, they're running for public offices throughout the West. So I think recognizing that, you know, thinking critically about our public figures and about our public actions and our public responsibilities, you know, there are interventions that we can perform even as ordinary people simply by going and voting or running for office yourself. You know, these are actions any of us could take to help prevent, you know, big apocalypses as well as slightly smaller ones.
And I suppose it's an interesting time to think about this because we are living in an age whereby if we think about, you know, individual and collective responses and you translate that to the supranational level, we think about, you know, the way that nations increasingly are acting individualistically in terms of, you know, how they respond to global crises. You know, the US withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement is probably the key example, but there are hundreds of in between. It's a really interesting point to think about. You know, there are democratic ways of getting involved to ensure that you know you do have a voice in this collective response.
I do think one thing that's really interesting, though, is, you know, we keep talking about people like Al Gore, these prophets of the eco apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And one of the, you know, fascinating things I find, you know, in terms of doing some of the reading for my class next term, I was just looking at some of the ways in which modern Mormon splinter groups who believe in direct revelation, right, that any person can be a prophet, the way in which they know if a prophet is true, and this goes all the way back to Deuteronomy, where Moses is talking about how the people of Israel will know if a prophet is a real prophet or not, and it's whether or not the prophecy is true, whether or not it comes out, which I think is not a massive amount of comfort, but I do think that at some point Al Gore will be shedding a silent tear, maybe he's already, you know, recognizing that whatever he says, we will only know if he's right through hindsight.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Yeah. So thank you both very much for coming in and giving up a little bit of time to talk about a fairly stern subject. Let me ask you slightly more casually, what is your particular interest or favorite apocalyptic scenario, and what would you do in that situation?
Well, see, I've played enough zombie video games that I feel like I've got at least a conceptual hold on that. Not that I would want it, obviously not. But, you know, it lets you get out some of the more visceral engagements with apocalyptic narratives.
Gavin goes with zombies. Leo, on yourself?
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking of sort of Mad Max, Waterworld style, just open landscape or waterscape, and some kind of having to live a nomadic lifestyle, moving around, evading threats and harms, and looking for food and water. Again, I'd echo Gavin's point that it's not the future I hope for, but I suppose it's one that has a certain romanticism to it in the way it's portrayed in Hollywood, at least.
Well, it's pretty much everywhere around us. So you get your critical hats on when you read the news, when you're watching TV. Think about those narratives. Think about what the apocalyptic imaginary really means, and how it is all around us, and how it can inform our responses to global challenges. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. Don't forget you can subscribe in all the normal ways, and we look forward to you listening to another episode before too long.